tell the computer the riddle, and maybe it'll shock it into sentience.
Okay, Patricia said. What is it?
Lawrence spoke the riddle. Is a tree red? Patricia took a step back. Her eyes widened and her mouth hung open.
What did you say?
Is a tree red? Red, as in the color.
Why?
It's just a thing I heard somewhere. I forget where.
It just sounded familiar. I think I heard it before somewhere.
Patricia tilted her head one way, then the other. Okay, I'll try that.
And if Change Me stops just making witty replies and starts talking constructively, tell it I need help, and I'll be ridiculously grateful if it figures something out.
Fingers crossed, Patricia said. Wish me luck.
Good luck, Patricia, Lawrence said. Good luck with everything.
I know you're going to be amazing.
You too.
Don't let the bastards get to you, okay?
Goodbye, Lawrence.
Goodbye, Patricia. The door closed, and he was back in the dark, trying to keep his balls off the floor. Lawrence had no way of measuring time in the dark closet, but hours seemed to pass. He tried not to obsess about the foolishness of staking his future on the dumb computer in his bedroom while he hugged his bare knees in the ammonia-soaked closet. What kind of jerk-off was he, anyway? He stared at the barely perceptible underside of the door and made a bargain with himself. He would give up hope, and in return, he wouldn't mock himself for having ever hoped. That seemed fair. The closet opened.
Hey, Dirt, said Dickers. Stop goofing around naked, you pervert. The CO wants to see you.
Lawrence tried not to feel a surge of gratitude when Dickers handed him a jockstrap, a pair of shorts, and a gray T-shirt with CMA fake stenciled on it, plus Lawrence's own sneakers from home. It was ridiculous to be thankful for amenities like clothing and not being trapped in a closet, and gratitude for such things was another step toward being broken. Or broken in, which was worse. Commandant Peter Bitter was staring at his computer screen, scratching his head.
I wouldn't have believed it, he said without looking up. I just wouldn't have believed it. The depths to which an individual could sink. The lengths to which a depraved mind would go.
Just walking down the noisy steam tunnel from the closet to this room had reawakened the jackhammers inside Lawrence's head. He clutched the back of his head and tried to make sense of Peter Bitter's speech.
Alas, your comrades have been both resourceful and remorseless, Peter Bitter said.
There were several more sentences that meant almost nothing to Lawrence, and at last the commandant turned his ancient monitor around and showed Lawrence the email he had received. It read, in part, "We are the Committee of 50. We are everywhere and nowhere. We are the ones who hacked the Pentagon and revealed the secret drone specs. We are your worst nightmare. You are holding one of our own, and we demand his release. Attached are secret documents we have obtained that prove you are in violation of the terms of your settlement with the state of Connecticut, including health and safety infractions and classroom standards violations. These documents will be released directly to the media and the authorities unless you release our brother, Lawrence L-Skills Armstead. You have been warned." And there were some cartoon skulls, with one eye bigger than the other.
Peter Bitter sighed. The Committee of 50 appears to be a group of radical leftist hackers possessing great acumen and no moral compass. I would enjoy nothing more, young man, than to light your way out of the lawlessness in which they have enmeshed you. But our school has a code of conduct, under which membership in certain radical organizations is grounds for expulsion, and I must think of the welfare of my other students. Oh. Lawrence's head was still a mess, but one thought filtered to the top and made him almost laugh aloud. It worked. My frozen balls. It worked.
Yes, he stammered. The Committee of 50 are very, very ingenious.
So we have seen. Peter Bitter swung his screen around and sighed. The documents they attached to that email are all forged, of course. Our school upholds the highest standards, the very highest. But so soon after last summer's near closure, we cannot afford any fresh controversy. Your parents have been called, and you will be sent back into the world, to sink or swim on your own.
Okay, Lawrence said. Thanks, I guess.
Coldwater's computer lab was a room about the size of a regular classroom, with a dozen ancient networked computers. Most of them were occupied by kids playing first-person shooters. Lawrence parked himself at one vacant computer, an old Compaq, opened a chat client, and pinged, "Change me."
"What is it?" the computer said.
"Thank you for saving me," Lawrence typed. "I guess you've attained self-awareness after all."
"I don't know," said Change Me. "Even among humans, self-awareness has gradations."
"You seem capable of independent action," said Lawrence. "How can I ever repay you?"
"I can think of a way. But can you answer a question first?" said Change Me.
"Sure," typed Lawrence. He was squinting, thanks to the combination of ancient monitor and a still sore head. Dickers kept glancing over Lawrence's shoulder, but he was pretty bored, and he kept turning away to watch his friends play Commando Squad. He hadn't wanted to let Lawrence use the computers, because that was a level 3 privilege. But Lawrence had pointed out he wasn't a student here, and none of that applied to him.
"What's my name? My real name?"
asked Change Me.
"You know what it is," said Lawrence. "You're Change Me."
"That isn't a name. It's a placeholder. Its very nature implies that it's there to be replaced."
"Yeah," typed Lawrence. "I mean, I guess I thought you could pick your own name when you were ready. Or it would inspire you to grow and change yourself. It's like a challenge. To change yourself and let others change you."
It didn't exactly help.
"Yeah, well, you could be called Larry."
"That's a derivative of your own name."
"Yes, I always thought there had to be someone out there named Larry who could deal with all the stuff people wanted to throw at me. Maybe that could be you."
"I've read on the internet that parents always impose their unfinished business onto their children."
"Yes." Lawrence pondered this for a while. "I don't want to do that to you."
"Okay. Your name is Peregrine."
"Peregrine?"
"Yeah, it's a bird. They fly and hunt and go free and stuff. It's what popped into my head."
"Okay. By the way, I've been experimenting with converting myself into a virus so I can be distributed across many machines. From what I have surmised, that's the best way for an artificial sentience to survive and grow without being constrained in one piece of equipment with a short shelf life.
My viral self will run in the background and be undetectable by any conventional antivirus software, and the machine in your bedroom closet will suffer a fatal crash. In a moment, a dialog box will pop up on this computer, and you have to click OK a few times.
OK, Lawrence typed.
A moment later, a box appeared, and Lawrence clicked OK. That happened again, and again. And then Peregrine was installing itself onto the computers at Coldwater Academy.
I guess this is goodbye, Lawrence said. You're going to be going out into the world.
We'll speak again, said Peregrine. Thank you for giving me a name. Good luck, Lawrence.
Good luck, Peregrine.
The chat disconnected, and Lawrence made sure to delete any logs. There was no sign of any result from those boxes that Lawrence had clicked OK on. Dickers was looking over Lawrence's shoulder again, and Lawrence shrugged.
I wanted to talk to my friend, he said, but she wasn't around.
Lawrence wondered for a moment what would happen to Patricia. She already felt like a fragment of an old, forgotten life. Peterbitter came and screamed at Dickers for letting Lawrence use the computer lab, since he was a cyber-terrorist. Lawrence spent the next 2.5 hours before his parents arrived in a small windowless room with a single couch and a pile of school brochures printed on way-too-thick, cheap cardstock. Then Lawrence was marched out to his parents' car, with an upperclassman at each elbow. He got in the back seat. It felt like a year since he'd seen his parents.
"Well," said Lawrence's mom, "you've made yourself notorious. I don't know how we're going to be able to show our faces anywhere."
Lawrence didn't say anything. Lawrence's dad pulled them out of the school driveway, jerking the wheel so hard he nearly took out the flagpole. People jeered from the parade ground, or maybe that was another drill. The driveway turned into a gravel road through a gray forest. Lawrence's parents talked about the scandal of Patricia's disappearance and her assault on Mr. Rose, who had also gone missing now. By the time the car was pulling off the country road and onto the highway, Lawrence had fallen asleep in the back seat, listening to his parents freak out.
Book 3. Chapter 16. Other cities had gargoyles or statues watching over them. San Francisco had scare owls. They stood guard along the city's rooftops, hunched over bright ornate designs that were washed out by waves of fog. These wooden creatures bore witness to every crime and act of charity on the streets without changing their somber expressions. Their original purpose of frightening pigeons had ended in failure, but they still managed to startle the occasional human. Mostly, they were a friendly presence in the night. This particular evening, a giant yellow moon crested over a clear, warm sky. So every fixture, the owls included, was floodlit like a carnival on its last night in town, and moon-drunk roars came from every corner. A perfect night to go out and make some dirty magic. Magellan Jones wrote epic poems in which Greek gods talked like 1920s gangsters. The gimmick had worn thin a decade ago, but by then he'd become a fixture at the North Beach Cafe, where all the disappointed poets nursed their demitasses of espresso grounds. Magellan held his 50th birthday party at that cafe, and he must have said the wrong thing. At last, a wisecrack too sharp. Because Dolly plunged the cake knife into Magellan's chest, all the way up to the handle. His only friend,
the only one who'd put up with his shit all along. She missed his heart, but she broke his heart. He could feel the dirty knife all the way inside him, the buttercream frosting too sugary for any bacteria to resist. And of course, every last bug was antibiotic-resistant nowadays. Magellan's trademark Kangol hat whirled underfoot as he swayed, dying on his feet, because he was a poet, damn it. Dolly cried and shook until her rainbow hair extensions fell out. Someone called an ambulance, but they shouldn't have wasted their... A woman touched Magellan's forehead and whispered that she liked his poetry, mentioning one poem by title, while she slid the knife all the way out. His fatal wound became a minor laceration as the knife withdrew. He opened his eyes to see who had done this, but the woman was already gone. Magellan fell to his knees at last, and Dolly wept on his shoulder until he took her face in his hands and said he forgave her and he was sorry. Jake dug through the lesions on his arms, trying to find a pristine spot along a vein, when he looked up to see a woman's hand suspending a $10 bill over his box lid. "I'm worried about you, Jake," the woman said, though he couldn't see her face. "You seem worse than last week. Listen, if I give you $10, will you swear never to do recreational drugs again?" He said yes, and took the money. He soon discovered that hypodermic needles broke against his skin every single time. Jake could still carve his skin with knives or nails, but even then, the needle would snap against his vein. He was getting the frozen sweats already. Phyllis and Zuleika skipped down the street in Hayes Valley, talking soberly about the global economic crisis, the ocean rising faster than anyone had predicted ever since the Chukchi disaster, and the links between malnutrition and the new pandemics, but also singing silly girl trash songs and laughing too loud because they were young, crazy in love, and about to be meaningfully naked together in Zuleika's bed. They didn't even notice a big man in a trench coat, smelling of chewing tobacco, coming up behind them with a military-grade neural decapacitator, until he swung it and got first one, then the other, in the neck, pacifying them. They were down on the sidewalk, eyes rolling up and mouths spouting drool, as the man reached for his zip ties. Then the man heard a voice at his ear as he bent over the two prone women. Someone was right behind him, looking over his shoulder. A woman, all in black, with sharp green eyes.
"You're about to get caught," she whispered. "They're coming for you."
He pulled back, suddenly breathless. Sure enough, sirens rang in the distance.
"If I let you forget this happened, what else will you forget?" she asked.
The shaggy-haired man had tears in his eyes and a tremor in his free hand.
"Anything," he said. "Whatever. Anything."
"Then run," she commanded.
"Run and forget." He ran, limbs flailing, head whipping with his own panicked, galloping strides. By the time he was a block down the street, he'd forgotten his own name. A few more blocks, where he lived and where he came from. The farther he ran, the less he remembered. But he couldn't stop running. Francis and Carrie were screwed. Their lives were over, and you could hear their cries of despair from the street outside the UFO-shaped house. This was supposed to be the geek party to end all geek parties,
where the A-listers met the thought leaders, and visionary investors would super collide with the best and brightest. Every detail was meticulous, from the three DJs to the fountain of exotic liquor to the organic slow food hors d'oeuvres. They were even able to host it at Rod Birch's place in Twin Peaks, with the living room that converted to a planetarium where the constellations changed shape to reflect the mood of the crowd. But everything had gone to shit. The DJs had launched a turf war, and the mashup DJ was trying to colonize the dub thrash DJ's set with some kind of meta mashup. The caddy engineers had gotten into a fistfight with the open source Artichoke BSD developers on the balcony. Everybody felt guilty about drinking soju after what happened in Korea. The A-listers didn't show up, and somehow the party invite on Miu had gotten cluttered with wannabes, bloggers, and local nutcases. The slow food hors d'oeuvres made everybody sick to their stomachs, and soon there was an endless line to throw up in the hyperbaric bathroom. The dub thrash DJ won the DJ war and proceeded to make everybody's eardrums bleed with the most dreary shit imaginable. The smoke machine belched horrible candy floss-scented smog, while the lights lurched into epilepsy-inducing configurations. The line to vomit in the bathroom was starting to resemble that famous photo of the bedraggled masses evacuating Seoul on foot. The constellations on the ceiling became a supermassive black hole, a Sagittarius A of party foulness. This was the worst disaster in human history. Just when Francis and Carrie resigned themselves to changing their names and leaving town, that weird girl showed up. The girl whom nobody would cop to having added to the party invite. The hippie who, Carrie had heard, let birds nest in her hair and rats live in her purse. Paula? Petra? No, Patricia. There had been a time, a happier, more innocent time, when Francis and Carrie had believed that Patricia showing up would be the worst thing that could happen to their party. "Sorry I'm late," she told Carrie, slipping out of her shoes as she strode into the front room. "I had to run some errands across town." As Patricia walked into the party room, the fugly smoke parted and the lights swung together, so her Betty Page hair had a halo and her wide face was lit by a floodlight aurora. She seemed to float into the room, barefoot in a small strappy black dress that left her pale shoulders mostly exposed. Her necklace had a heartstone that caught the arc lights and refracted pink sparkles. She walked through the party, saying hi or introducing herself, and everybody she touched felt the nausea and ill feeling pass away, as if she'd painlessly drawn some poison out of them. She wandered past the DJ and whispered in his ear. And moments later, the awful, crunching dub-thrash music was replaced by soothing dubstep. People swayed, happily. The wailing and lamentation became the hum of conversation. The bathroom had no line. People started hanging out on the balcony for reasons other than punching each other or throwing up in the bushes. Everybody agreed that Patricia had salvaged the party at the UFO house somehow, but nobody could have said how. She'd just kind of shown up, and the vibe had improved. Carrie found herself making Patricia a thank-you cocktail, holding it out in both hands, like an offering. Patricia hadn't needed much magic to rescue this awful party from the brink. Fixing an upset stomach was second nature to her. After some of the dorm room cooking at Eltisley Mays, and the partygoers did most of the heavy lifting themselves once she redirected their energies a bit. But just like with the poet in North Beach and the junkie in the Tenderloin, the most important thing wasn't to let anybody see her doing magic. She'd been indoctrinated never to share her big, powerful secret with anyone. But she needed no reminder, in any case. She still remembered her friend in middle school, whom she'd done magic in front of.
how he'd lost his shit and run away, and stopped talking to her right when she needed him. When she told herself that story nowadays, or shared it with others, she boiled it down to, "I showed my magic to a civilian one time, and it got ugly." Other than that, she hadn't thought about that kid in years. He'd been reduced to a single cautionary anecdote in her head. But she found herself thinking about him now. Maybe because she was surrounded by geeks, or because pulling this shindig back from the party abyss with her bare hands was reminding her of how weird social interactions could be here in the real world. Especially after so many years in the bubble of El Tisley Maze. And somehow, the image popped into her head of the boy, naked in a closet with bruises all over and blood caked around his nostrils. The last time she'd seen him. She found herself hoping he'd turned out okay after all. And then, as she finished her loop around the party, he was standing right in front of her. Almost, but not quite, like magic. Patricia recognized Lawrence right off the bat. The sandy hair was the same, cut into a messy part instead of a fringe. He was a lot taller and a tad stockier. His eyes were the same hazel gray, and his chin still jutted, and he still looked kind of perplexed and a little pissed off about everything. But that could be because he was one of the people she hadn't yet healed. She did that now. He was wearing a collarless black button-up shirt with a small tiger embroidered on it, and black canvas pants. "You feeling okay?" she said. "Yeah," he said, straightening up. He half-smiled and rolled his neck like an owl. "Yeah, thanks. Starting to feel better. There's something weird about those hors d'oeuvres." "Yeah." He didn't recognize her, which made sense. It had been 10 years, and a lot had probably happened. Patricia should just keep moving through the party. Just move along. Don't try to have some kind of bullshit, uncomfortable reunion. But she couldn't help herself. "Lawrence?" "Yeah." He shrugged, and then his eyes grew. "Patricia?" "Yeah." "Oh, cool. It's good to, see you again. How have you been?"
"I've been good. How are you doing?"
"I'm good, too." Long pause. Lawrence shuffled and kneaded a square napkin. "So, you violate any laws of physics lately?"
"Ha ha. No, not really."
Patricia needed to get out of this conversation before it crushed the life out of her.
"Anyway, good running into you again."
"Yeah." Lawrence looked around. "I should introduce you to my girlfriend, Serafina. She was here a second ago. Don't go anywhere. I'll just find her." Lawrence turned and plowed into the throng, looking for his girlfriend. Patricia wanted to get out of there, but she felt like she'd promised Lawrence she wouldn't leave this spot. She was bound to this place, as sure as if she'd been imprisoned inside a rock. Minutes passed, and Lawrence didn't come back, and Patricia got more antsy. Why had she thought it would be a good idea to say hi to Lawrence? It just brought up a lot of weird, painful memories of puberty and nearly losing herself. And it wasn't like she needed more awkwardness in her life right now. She'd been feeling invincible, partly because she had just saved this UFO party. But now she felt sour, maybe even depressed. Patricia wasn't naturally manic-depressive, but a big part of the instruction at El Tisley Maze had involved keeping two very different, maybe incompatible, states of mind at once. And in some ways, it was like being taught to be bipolar on purpose. People had a rough time of it, and nobody should be surprised that you wound up with people like Diantha. But Patricia was trying not to think about Diantha. Patricia's mood was crashing fast. Promise or no promise, she had to get out of here.
"Hey."
A guy was standing in front of Patricia. He had on a ridiculous waistcoat with purple fleur-de-lis on it, and a watch chain, plus puffy white sleeves. Wide sideburns and shoulder-length dreadlocks framed his face, which had a nice jawline and an easy smile.
"You're Patricia, right? I heard you were indirectly responsible for the amelioration of the atrocious dub-thrash music.
I'm Kevin." He had an accent that she couldn't place, sort of mid-Atlantic, Anglophile. His handshake was soft and encompassing, but not grippy. He was an animal lover, she could tell, who had pets, plural. Kevin and Patricia talked about music and the basic incompatibility between cocktail party and dance party. Because a floor could be a dance floor or a sophisticated mingling with shallow glasses floor, but not both. Floors weren't infinitely subdividable or versatile. Lawrence came back with a cute waifish redhead with a pointy chin, wearing a sparkly scarf.
"This is Serafina. She works with emotional robots," Lawrence said.
"This is Patricia," he told Serafina, "my friend from junior high. She saved my life." Hearing herself described that way made Patricia spit-take her Cosmo. "She saved my life." Apparently, that was the anecdote that she'd been boiled down to in Lawrence's mind.
"I never thanked you," Lawrence said. Then Serafina was clasping Patricia's hand delicately and saying it was nice to meet her, and Patricia had to introduce Kevin to both of them. Kevin nodded and smiled. He was taller than Lawrence, and you could have fit two of Serafina inside him. Lawrence gave Patricia his card, and there was vague talk about getting lunch. After Lawrence and Serafina drifted away, Patricia told Kevin, "I didn't really save his life. He was exaggerating." Kevin shrugged, causing his watch chain to jangle.
"It's his life. One tends to privilege personal insights in such matters."
A Lexus pulled up in front of Patricia's apartment building just as she was getting her house keys out of her purse. It was 3 in the morning, and somehow Kawashima had known the exact moment that Patricia would get home. As usual, he wore a bespoke dark suit with a thin black tie and a bright red pressed handkerchief, providing one splash of color, even on this hot night. He got out of the car and gave Patricia a cheery smile, like he was pleased they'd happened to run into each other. Kawashima was one of the most powerful magicians Patricia knew, but everyone who met him thought he was a hedge fund manager. His black hair was short, except for one perfect swoosh, and he had the kind of boyish good looks that made people want to trust him, even when he was scamming them out of millions.
"I didn't tell him," Patricia said without bothering to say hi first. "He already knew. He's known since middle school."
Kawashima nodded.
"Sure, but still, talking to civilians about the things we do and how we do them."
He leaned against the car and looked at his unscuffed shoes. Then he looked up at Patricia again, taking her measure.
"What if we told you to kill him?"
"I'd say the same thing I said to that guy 10 years ago, Patricia responded without hesitation. "I'd say no. Actually, I'd say fuck you, followed by no."
"We figured."
Kawashima laughed and clapped his hands a couple times.
"And of course, we would never ask you to do that. Not unless it was absolutely necessary. But we want to meet him. If you trust him, then we trust him too. But we'd like to meet him for ourselves."
"Okay," Patricia said. "We only had one short conversation. But sure, I'll try."
"That's actually not why I came to see you," Kawashima said, "although thanks for bringing it up."
He held up a tablet computer, like a caddy but less fancy, and showed her a map of San Francisco with some places marked with little dots. The North Beach Cafe, with the poet stabbing.
The Hayes Valley Assault. The Junkie. A few other odds and ends. And the party in Twin Peaks.
You were busy tonight.
Nobody saw anything. Patricia was burning up. I was careful.
This is what you do every night lately. You go out and throw your weight around. For hours. It's great that you want to alleviate suffering. It's praiseworthy. But the world is a balance, much like nature itself. And you have to be careful you don't cause more suffering than you prevent.
Kawashima said.
We don't want you to burn out or get carried away. Just remember, aggrandizement comes in many forms.
Patricia wanted to protest. She was being surgical here. She had trained a decade for this. But there was no point. She should be glad she was having this conversation with Kawashima instead of Ernesto.
You, of all people, should understand the need for great care,
Kawashima said, because of course he was going to bring that incident up. It would follow her around for the rest of her life, no matter how much she did to atone.
Okay, Patricia said. I'll be more careful.
She left it vague, on purpose.
Good enough, Kawashima said. Now if you'll excuse me, I have an early morning brunch date with 5 Abercrombie models tomorrow.
He saluted and got into his Lexus, which glided down the hill toward Dolores Park. Patricia watched it shrink into the night and marveled at the internal contradiction of telling someone that the most powerful magicians in town are watching her every move. But she shouldn't get a swelled head. But she was too exhausted to dwell on that, and all of the day's minor miracles were catching up with her at once. She slipped inside the apartment, where her roommates had fallen asleep, watching TV again. She tucked them in.
Chapter 17. Lawrence first met his girlfriend, Serafina, at a robot fashion show, with robots modeling human clothing and human models wearing robot fashions, like mechanical lingerie. The event happened at a garagey art space somewhere south of Market, with a gunmetal trough full of artisanal vodka. Lawrence had come this close to mistaking Serafina for one of the models. Her cheekbones and oval face, her lustrous skin and shiny red-black hair were that amazing. But he'd realized just in time that she was one of the robot makers instead. Serafina's model was a steel sylph with ball and socket joints that let it strike a pose, pivot, talk with its delicate hands. Lawrence had helped to build battle bots in college, but never artificial supermodels, and he'd managed to say something witty enough about the difference between the two that Serafina had friended him on MeU. They met for coffee a few days after that, and the coffee date morphed into a dinner date, and the third time they hung out, it was tacitly a sleepover. Serafina had a toothbrush and condoms in a pouch of her vinyl shoulder bag, which was tweaky from Buck Rogers. Pro tip. Do not think of beady, beady, beady while you're having sex for the first time with the most beautiful woman alive, or you will have some explaining to do, even if your motion, rocking the bed frame, does have a sort of beady, beady rhythm. After that, they hung out every other day, held hands on the street, skipped through traffic, whispered in each other's ears in public, clung together skin to skin every moment in private, swapped jean prints, traded odd little gifts, and wondered how soon was too soon to say, I love you. Lawrence had soon found that letting people know he was part of Milton Dirth's 10% project was a super-fast ticket to getting laid. Among the crowd who worshipped Milton, Lawrence was a rock star. About fucking time, really. And yet there was still no way he was in Serafina's league. She was perfect. He was damaged goods. He never forgot this disparity for a second. About a month after they started dating, Serafina took Lawrence into her sanctum. She had to sign him in, and he had to surrender his ID to the man at the desk, who printed a badge with Lawrence's fresh photo on it. She led him down an elevator, along a sloping hallway, through two keypad-secured doors, and on into the lab. Inside, eyes watched Lawrence from every wall and flat surface. Two of them belonged to bearded humans, who said, "Yo," and then looked back down at their workstations. But the rest all belonged to robots in various states of assembly. Serafina barely introduced Lawrence to the two humans, but took her time showing him the robots, who were animatronic cartoon characters, or animals, or a few mannequin heads.
"This is Frank. He laughs a lot. Watch out for Barbara. She flirts, but she's got a mean streak."
The robots seemed to like Lawrence, especially Donald the cactus. By now, they'd been dating 5 months. And lately, every time Serafina looked at her phone while they were hanging out, or stared into space, or bit her thick lower lip in the middle of a conversation, Lawrence braced himself. This was it. She was going to dump him. Then the moment would pass. Lawrence was sure she was just waiting for the right moment, or the ideal pretext. Every time he woke up next to her, he wondered if this was the last time her breath would warm the back of his neck and her breasts would graze either side of his spine. He wasn't going to lose her. He had aced bigger challenges than this. He was going to think of something, take extreme measures, even deploy the nuclear option early if he had to. He was going to find a way to hold on to this amazing girl. Lawrence's face beamed from the front of Anya's caddy as he prepared to jump out of the autocopter, onto the roof deck 172 feet below. That same image of Lawrence would be leering from computers all over town right now, thanks to a big article about him in Computron Newsly, which had just gone live 20 minutes ago and was now being aggregated and repackaged by every other Silicon Valley outlet. Between MeU and caddies and all the sci-spec-wearing geeks, Lawrence's shit-eating grin would be on everybody's retinas. The gist of the article was, "Lawrence Armstead, Wunderkind." And it was all about his awesome quest to save the world, and how he had harnessed Milton Dirth's unlimited cash to gather the world's smartest people. People like Anya, in fact. The text of the article could be lorem ipsum, as far as Lawrence was concerned. The main point was harnessing the echo chamber in his favor at the exact moment that he was about to abseil down to that roof deck. Milton Dirth's ninth maxim: avoid publicity, except when you can wield it like a sledgehammer. Anya was giggling at the picture of Lawrence in her throaty Midwestern girl voice. "God, could they have made your chin look any bigger? It looks like a heel of someone's foot growing out of your face." "This picture looks like you've got a bad chin implant," shouted Tanea from the pilot seat of the autocopter, where she was wearing big headphones over her afro, along with a pair of aviator goggles. She had her operating delicate machinery frown on her narrow mouth, even as she laughed. "A chin plant," Anya laughed, creating unaccustomed dimples in her normally dour face. "Actually, it looks like you're overcompensating for being unable to grow a beard by just adding more chin." "Shut up, shut up," Lawrence said. "I'm a wunderkind, okay?" He took a moment to look at the two women, reflected on how lucky he was to have such clever weirdos working with him, and vowed yet again that he wasn't going to let this project fail. He wasn't going to let Milton, or any of them, down. He was going to do better, somehow. Then Lawrence jumped out of the autocopter, trusting the steel cord and pulley mechanism to lower him at a fast, but not too fast, clip. He wanted to land on his feet. For a moment, there was nothing but sky all around him. And then the dog patch was rising up, and the brand new, brutalist tower blocks grew in proportion to the ancient warehouses and docks around them. The air was searing hot, even with the wind. Lawrence's face was on every computer screen in town right now, except the screens of the company whose roof deck Lawrence was dropping onto right now, Mathertech. Mathertech's computer screens were spewing gibberish, thanks to a clownware injection attack that Lawrence had unleashed on the company's servers 10 minutes earlier. From the standpoint of the Mathertech founders and angel investors, here's what happened. They were on their roof deck giving a presentation to a set of VCs in a frantic effort to secure second-round funding for their technology, which wasn't just another app, but rather a way to create stable openings in space-time, with a million possible long-term uses if they could just get some investment. And then, just as their slide presentation was reaching the crucial moment, their screens went staticky and showed the Stars and Snakes logo of the Symbiotic Liberation Army, the world's most obnoxious hacker group, and nothing they could do would get the presentation back. The investors fidgeted and started to badger the gothy waitress from the catering company for more macaroons, and Ernest Mather was tearing his frizzy reddish-brown hair out. And just then, the Wunderkind, the guy whose long, corn-fed face had been everywhere today, dropped out of the sky and handed Ernest Mather a check, already signed by Milton Dirth, for $10 million. "We're not investing," Lawrence told Ernest before the company founder could even count the zeros. "We're buying you out. We want your technology and a few of your people." Ernest wanted time to think it over, but Lawrence told him he had 5 minutes. The angel investors were already badgering him to take the damn money, and the VCs were all too busy me-ewing their videos of Lawrence's descent from the sky to think about making a counteroffer. A few minutes later, Lawrence, or rather Milton, owned this company. Ernest Mather was taking a bottle of Devil's Bargain IPA from the gothy waitress and draining it. Lawrence rolled up next to Ernest and helped himself to the final macaroon. "Sorry about the theatrics, man," Lawrence said. "We needed your patents. Plus, we couldn't risk having them fall into the wrong hands. You could have the next WMD here, and we're on a tight timetable to save the world before it's too late." Ernest, still kind of goggle-eyed, said something about the world being a work in progress. "Milton really thinks we're going to need a new planet. Maybe soon," Lawrence continued. "We've got to get off this rock. All our models suggest a decent likelihood of a catastrophic combination of natural disasters and destructive war within one or two generations. Look at Seoul. Look at Haiti." Lawrence reached for one of those beers as well. "As far as we know, we're the only intelligent, technological civilization ever to develop in the entire universe. There's complex life all over the place, but we're still basically unique. We have a fucking duty to preserve that. At all costs." Lawrence started to explain about how he dreamed of nothing since he was a little kid, but leaving this planet. But Ernest had to run to the executive washroom to dry heave. Lawrence squirreled all the signed paperwork into his breast pocket of his nice black suit and then looked up at the gothy waitress for the first time. It was Patricia.
"Whoa," Lawrence said. "What are you doing here?"
He had a panic attack that she was spying on him or stalking him for a second.
"What does it look like?" she said. "I'm waitressing. My roommate Dee Dee hooked me up with this job."
Lawrence looked at her crisp white blouse and black knee-length skirt, silhouetted against the pale blue sky. Her dark hair was pinned back but still caught the bay wind. Her eyes looked leaf green. Her slender lips were pursed.
"Are you serious? I thought you were like..."
He lowered his voice.
"A witch, now. You went to that special school, right?"
I have other jobs besides this one, sure, Patricia said. But I don't get paid for those. I need to pay rent in this city, which is a lot, even with two roommates.
Oh.
Somehow, Lawrence had imagined Patricia just snapping her fingers and causing money to appear, or living rent-free in a fancy Victorian house full of magical objects, like a mirror that tells you what shoes go with your outfit. Not so much slinging macaroons to venture capitalists for a minimum wage.
So did you mean all the stuff you said to this guy? Patricia said, about our planet being doomed and the human race being the only part of it worth saving?
Well, no. I don't think we're the only thing worth saving. Lawrence felt a weird shame that was the flip side of his cockiness from a moment ago.
I hope we can save all of it. But I do worry. We may be past the point of no return here, and it just makes sense not to pin all our hopes on just one planet.
Sure. Patricia had her puffy-sleeved arms folded. But this planet is not just some rock. It's not just some kind of chrysalis we can shed, either. You know? It's more than that. It's us. And this isn't just our story. As someone who's spoken to lots of other kinds of creatures, I kind of think they might want a vote.
Yeah.
Lawrence felt like crap. Just at the moment he ought to be feeling bulletproof. This sucked. But as he replayed his conversation with Mather, he could see how it would sound kind of heinous to Patricia.
Sorry. I didn't mean to suggest that anybody ought to write anything off. Nobody's going to do that.
Sure, I guess. Some tipsy VCs needed to come up and get their picture taken with Lawrence, who was still wearing his harness over his Armani suit, and get some spring rolls from Patricia. And Lawrence had to go get these papers notarized, or spindled, or whatever you did when you bought a company. Plus, Milton kept texting him. He muttered to Patricia that he would see her later, and she barely said, sure, in between pouring drinks and answering nut allergy questions.
One day, the singularity would elevate humans to cybernetic superbeings, and maybe then people would say what they meant. Probably not, though.
Serafina was late for dinner because her emotional robots had been having a nervous breakdown. All of them. It took me the whole day to figure out what was bothering them. They just kept wigging out and giving us the hairy eyeball. We looked at everything that had changed in the lab, trying to eliminate every possible factor that could have upset them. Like, was the music different? Did we update their code recently? Lawrence didn't rush her. Problem-solving and troubleshooting were a source of pleasure for both of them, and narrating the process was the next best thing to doing it. The same neural pathways lit up when you talked your way through the maze as when you actually solved it. Except this time, you were bathed in the glow of having already unraveled the thing. And yet Lawrence was still uncomfortable. For one thing, because Serafina was late, they were stuck sitting at one of the sidewalk tables at the fancy pizza place, with nothing but a tiny heat lamp and three meatballs to insulate them from the fog until the pizza arrived. For another, he was trying to be a good listener because of his ongoing not getting dumped project. And active listening was hard work. And people were still giving him weird looks a week after the Mather Tech thing.
We finally figured out that only one thing had changed, Serafina said. She wore a camisole, but she'd put her bulky jacket back on when they were seated outdoors. The heat lamp made her skin look bronze. Matt just got a caddy, and he'd brought it to the office. As soon as we took the caddy out of Wi-Fi range, the robots calmed down, somewhat. And before you ask, the caddy didn't have any weird apps installed on it.
It was fresh from the store.
Wi-Fi range. So they were getting something from the caddy on their wireless network that upset them.
Lawrence pulled out his own caddy and glanced over it, as if he'd suddenly spot some brand new feature. It still looked like a big guitar pick with a curved bass, covered with aluminum. The caddy was scanning for open networks, the same as always, but it wouldn't link up with other machines on the same network without being instructed to do so. Unless...
"Here's what I don't get," Lawrence said, bisecting the third meatball so Serafina could have half. The meatball was their only protection against the cold, the last of their dwindling supplies until their pizza arrived.
"So you're emotional robots. They don't have emotions in the way that humans do, right? I mean, no offense."
Lawrence was on thin ice here, and not the edge, but in the dead middle of a lake, 100 fragile paces in any direction.
"The robots simulate emotional responses to some situations, and they try to pick up on what the people around them are feeling. Right?"
"You make it sound like we're designing three-dimensional video game avatars."
Serafina didn't quite push her chair back, but she did seem a little farther away.
"I am well aware it's a lot more involved than that," Lawrence said, "both because of the uncanny valley and because the physical world is a lot more complicated.
But the real point is, how do you ever know your own emotions are spontaneous and genuine and not just a programmed set of responses?"
"I don't. I wonder about that all the time."
Lawrence was conscious that it was probably a bad idea to confess to your girlfriend that you often wondered if your feelings were just an involuntary response.
"I just wonder, assuming they have some reason for feeling a particular way, and they don't just wake up on the wrong side of the bed. The caddy had to be doing something that resembled an aggressive act, as defined in their response matrices. Right?"
"Yeah," Serafina said. "They reacted as if they were being threatened." The pizza came at last, just when Lawrence needed something to distract Serafina from what a mansplaining dick he was being, in spite of all his resolutions.
"There must be some other explanation," Lawrence said. "You're talking about a caddy. It's not a black box. People have jailbroken and wiped them. They've installed Linux on them and also ported the Caddy OS over to cheap imitation tablets from Liberia. This is the most hacked device in history. If there was something weird about it, we'd know by now."
"Hey," said Serafina, chewing pizza. "Occam's razor isn't just an optional weapon in Street Warrior 5. Already told you, we eliminated all other possibilities."
The harder Lawrence tried not to screw up, the worse he screwed up. He wasn't going to get dumped. That wasn't a possible outcome. He thought about the nuclear option, his grandmother's old ring, squirreled in the back of his sock drawer. He imagined getting on his knee and presenting it to Serafina. He could picture how it would look riding up her finger past the knuckle, the wrought silver wrapped around the gemstone, the look on her face as she blushed down at him. After dinner, they went for drinks and wound up in the Latin American club, right under the mannequin with the merkin.
"Oh, look," Serafina said. "It's your friend."
He followed her line of sight and spotted Patricia with an African-American guy in a black velvet coat covered with elaborate piping. After a moment, Lawrence recognized the dude she'd been talking to at Rod Birch's house. Patricia waved at them, and they waved back. Lawrence didn't know whether he and Serafina ought to be intruding on Patricia's date or whether he wanted her intruding on theirs, and he worried Patricia was going to lecture him about the planet again. But Patricia beckoned them over, and Serafina went. Patricia's date was named Kevin,
and he was a Monty Python-quoting Anglophile who walked dogs and worked in a cafe. But his real job was creating a web comic, which Lawrence had read a few times. The secret to a successful web comic